This is the third John Barron tape, and it's the 14th of March, 2000. Why don't we just start with that expedition over again?
All right, I went down in the 91 season, and there was a, that was the first field season of the Kazerts, as I explained. More of a test season, worked for, I did not stay out in the field with them. I had to get off to the Antarctic Treaty meeting in Viña del Mar, Chile. There was a long delay in getting airplanes down there that year, but I was in Antarctica briefly at the beginning of that program. Then I went down in 91, 92 and spent a short period of time out at the Kazerts camp when they were working. That's when the survey found the active volcano beneath the ice that received a lot of publicity. And we had a paper published in Nature with Don Blankenship, the senior author on that, with the rest of us in the program co-authors. That group continued to collect data, and moving more into the divide area of the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, I went down in the 94-95 season, which is my last trip to Antarctica, and was out there briefly and spent time at McMurdo and got to the South Pole and saw the changes. In fact, I've been to the South Pole a number of times and have taken a lot of pictures of the changes in the South Pole from 1961 through 1995, when some of the newest construction of the type that will be going in with the new South Pole station, the Astronomical Observatory, and the solar heated summer dormitory, which is are replacing the dome station, which replaced the old IGY buildings built right on the snow surface back in 1956, Arctic Peninsula Traverse, so I didn't hear any of what was going on.
61, 62. Okay, 1994-94, you saw the new facilities being built. They're still not finished.
Well, they weren't even being started. There was the Astronomical Observatory and one solar heated dormitory, but I think that's the type of construction, the new
stilts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That and makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's surprising that we did the dome after, you know, in Greenland we've been putting stuff on stilts for a long time.
And the Germans at Gondwana Station, for instance, and at other stations have used stilts.
Works good. Okay, what were you doing there? What was your purpose that season, 94-95?
Well, that was working with the, by this time it was called SOAR, the Aeromagnetic Air Geophysical Surveys over the divide area of the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. And that will be, those will be used, among other things, for selection of a drilling site for the West Antarctic Ice Sheet core, which is called the Waste Core. And I interpreted some of those aeromagnetic data to indicate a large caldera structure beneath the divide of the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. And I've been looking at the relation of the volcanic rocks that are erupted or injected into the ice, but not exposed above the ice, and how they are essentially removed by the ice as it moves along. And these are just debris, such as erupts under Iceland.
Oh, I forgot to key this.
So it hasn't been recording?
It's been recording, I just haven't keyed it. Hmm. Just put down the tape number. Mm-hmm. Redo it. I'll go back and rekey it. We probably won't have much on this.
Since 1995, I've been continuing to work on interpretations of these data and write papers. Also, in
So you haven't been down since...
No, but in 1997-98, a survey was flown with the Germans and the USGS participation and Ohio State participation helicopter, draped helicopter survey over the Butcher Ridge Igneous Complex. This is an area we got a profile over in the 1990-91 season and found a high-amplitude magnetic anomaly suggesting a buried intrusion like the Dufek intrusion. So this survey was flown, and I now have a grant from National Science Foundation to work on the interpretation of it, and that's what I'm working on at present, as well as the data over the West Antarctic ice sheet.
This is like the Dufek Massif, but it's
smaller.
It's smaller.
Much smaller.
And you have an NSF grant?
Working on that.
And that's what you're doing at the present?
That and continuing the interpretations of the West Antarctic ice sheet.
Okay, let me ask a couple questions. They're not going back, they're over a long period. You've been working on the negotiations of at the Antarctic Treaty. How many treaty meetings have you gone to?
22.
You've been to 22 international meetings?
Yes.
Been to, let me get this, 730.
That was between 1977 and 1995.
Were you State Department representative?
No, I was the Department of Interior or USGS scientific advisor to the State Department, but a member of the delegation, but as a scientific advisor.
Advisor to Tucker Scully?
Yes.
What was Tucker Scully's role?
Well, originally, he was back in 1977. You can check with him on exactly what his position was. That's when I first met him, and it was a London meeting where the ninth consultative meeting, I think it was, minerals were being discussed. It was the first consultative meeting where minerals were discussed, and he was a member of the delegation. He was a foreign service officer attached to the treaty delegation at that time, and over the years, he assumed more responsibilities and eventually became the actual or, in some cases, de facto head of delegation. In the meetings in Madrid where the environmental protocol was finally signed, I went to one of those meetings, there were three. Buff Bolin was the Assistant Secretary of State for OES at that time, and he was the head of the delegation.
Buff
Bolin, B-O-H-L-E-N. I think that was his title, Assistant Secretary for Oceans, Environment, and Science.
And when was that? What date was that?
Well, that was in the 90-91 period, including the meeting in Viña del Mar, Chile, and a Madrid meeting.
So he signed the protocol for
Yes, yeah. Initialed it, actually, and then the signing is done in the capitals of the various countries by some higher official, in effect, someone acting for the president, probably the Secretary of State. Or
it wasn't ratified until 98.
Yeah.
You attended these 22 meetings. 22 meetings.
After the environmental protocol was signed, I attended meetings in Germany and in Korea and in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Venice meeting in 92. I've got all, to try and keep track of all these, they were coming every year. And I was at night. There was something between Venice 92 and I'd have to look that up.
Are you still the geological advisor?
No, I'm not.
To the state?
No, because I'm not in the U.S. Geological Survey anymore.
Do you have to be a member of the government to go to these?
Only if let's put it this way, I would go if State Department chose to pay my way. They're very limited budget. When I went to USGS, paid my way.
Mm-hmm. I see. So
most of those periods of time, that NSF, for instance, all throughout the minerals negotiations, NSF was only sparsely represented. Some, mostly, but not always. I think later.
Were there other? I'm sorry.
Well, various agencies. NOAA was there, Marine Mammals Commission. There was usually an environmental delegate and a American Petroleum Institute person. But after the price of oil dropped, they stopped sending him. And at the time of the final negotiations of the environmental protocol, the Petroleum Institute and the American Petroleum Industry wasn't even interested in Antarctica anymore. The Interior Department during the Bush administration tried to be interested in the mining, but the American Mining Congress wasn't particularly interested. Nothing has ever been discovered would be an ore in the United States. And the investment capital required for petroleum, if it were in Antarctica, would be about double oil shale. So there's very little interest in
the general feeling by the meetings that Rutford and Elliot and I went to and others by the American Mining Congress that there was probably no future mining going to be taking place in Antarctica at all.
Yeah, I think that's so.
But petroleum is here for matter.
Yes, yeah. But also no one is particularly interested in petroleum at this time, and so it was not very hard to it was mainly the Interior Department that was holding off on the environmental, the prohibition on mineral resource activities other than research, which includes petroleum resources. And it was Interior, that not the President or the State Department, and U.S. was the holdout for a couple of years on that, and finally Bush made the decision to sign it in 1991.
In your long career of conducting research in the field in Antarctica, how has research changed? Certainly, you know, we're doing more things remotely, from airborne surveys to ship.
There are probably a higher number of researchers and grantees and scientists in going to Antarctica. They're much more constrained to the McMurdo Dry Valleys area and the South Pole in that axis, and then at Palmer Station where there's marine research, marine biological research active program in that area, and the ship, the Nathaniel Palmer research that's done off of that. But there is less field research now. There is field research that's being done in West Antarctica, mainly operating out of McMurdo, but not around in the Weddell Sea area or over in the Wilkes Station area, all the areas we were operating in the IGY. And I think a large amount of this is because the political incentives to do this have diminished. The Cold War is over. The United States is still keeping its station active in the South Pole. And the main reason for McMurdo is the logistic support of the South Pole. And I think if there were no science at all, they would still keep the South Pole station open in McMurdo. However, I don't think that's very, I think there's plenty of scientists that want to go to Antarctica, and so would always be putting in proposals to work out of those areas as well as Palmer Station. And it's the U.S., it keeps being reiterated every 10 or 15 years that it's the U.S. position to keep the South Pole station and a station in the peninsula area, and therefore the station at McMurdo, which is required to support the South Pole station.
More oceanographic research now?
The Nathaniel Palmer is a very, I haven't sailed on it, but I understand it's a very good research ship, much easier to work on than the icebreakers, including the Glacier and the Polar class icebreakers, which are not really set up for research, and is one of the world-class Antarctic research ships.
How about the Gould? Have you heard much about it?
I haven't heard much about it. Its mission is a little different. It's more to work out of Palmer Station, more supporting marine biological research, I understand, but it isn't ice strengthened to the point of the Palmer, so it can't go in the Weddell Sea in the wintertime like the Palmer did, for instance.
So you think that the Nathaniel Palmer is a better research platform than the Coast Guard icebreaker?
Oh, very much so. Not because of the ship capabilities, but just because of set up laboratories and
Icebreakers have other missions.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
How about the flying today compared to the flying support of field parties as compared to the early years?
Well, it took a long time to convince NSF that for geophysical work, you want to use the smallest possible airplanes in the area of your surveying, whatever the objective is, and then use the HERCs to support these small airplanes, or helicopters, as the case may be, for geological field parties. We did this first in Pensacola Mountains in 1965-66 season, but then there was the attempt in the 70s to instrument a HERC for geophysics, and that's very expensive, and it never worked very well. It was canceled after few years.
So a whole bunch of small planes is better than one large plane.
Well, we don't have the money in the program for more than one small plane for geophysical work, and not even for an entire season. All the instrumentation has to be put on and taken off every year, which is rather unusual for airborne survey aircraft, which are normally instrumented and kept running as much as possible.
These are Canboric air?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Another twin otter operates in Antarctica for the U.S. program, but that's mainly to carry geologists or other field parties around to deploy instruments. There's a lot more remote. The automatic geophysical observatories apparently are working quite satisfactorily. I have not worked with those data, but they can be put out with a HERC or probably with a twin otter. I'm not sure if they can. Twin otter can carry one. And then they telemeter data or store it and can be picked up a year later. There's some pretty impressive research going on right now, such as the balloon research, astronomical research at the South Pole. I don't mean I think it's a much more versatile research program than it was in the earlier days. But I think it operates out of that McMurdo-South Pole axis of support.
It's much more versatile, but it's localized in McMurdo.
Unless you can launch a balloon that'll go all around Antarctica, or
do that, top hat.
That's what I'm saying. Or the ships, the research ships, like the.
How about NOAA's presence down there? How much do they do now?
I'm not sure that they're doing much now.
I had some for a while.
Yeah.
Under Ned Stenzel, he had to.
Well, it was. But it was partly related to. Monitoring of activities. Tom Laughlin was instrumental in getting some of that through from NOAA. But I don't think they have a major. There may be NOAA people assigned to, like USGS people and other federal NASA people to the other program. The USGS ship doesn't go down there anymore. In fact, USGS doesn't have a ship anymore. It only made one cruise down there in 1984.
Okay, last question. Unless you can think of something else you want to cover. Yeah. Long career again. Reflecting back. High points, low points,
things you have
done differently?
Not particularly. I think going down on the IGY was difficult and somewhat dangerous, although we understood that when we went down. Larry Gould told us that if we fall in a crevasse, we'll be in much better shape 500 years than any of the rest of us. He told us that at the Davisville orientation in October 1956. And he loved Antarctica, and we learned to love it. We were innocents on the ice when we went down there, and we learned.
Would you do it all over? All over again?
Yes, so. Yes. I didn't spend my whole career during these years working on Antarctica. As I said earlier, I worked in Africa, the Rocky Mountains, and Western U.S. Gravity base station connections all over the world as a student. Marine geophysics off the continental margin of the United States. So I've worked in the Great Lakes doing deep crustal seismic work. Worked on Charleston earthquake. Research, so I've been doing this in as well as the Antarctic things, and I Think I've had a good mix of the type of research I've done. I kind of regret I haven't spent more time in the Arctic. I worked in Alaska in 1955 and 1956 and got up there a few times. I mentioned I got up on Ice Station Charlie briefly. But since that time, I've not been to Alaska, and I just haven't had time. Not the wish or the desire.
I appreciate all that. I had a question I was going to ask you, now I forget. You've written a book.
Yes.
What does, the book's called Innocence on Ice, and you just used that term again.
Innocence with a C. Unfortunately, Innocence with a T is when people ask at a bookstore sometimes and they can't find it.
Oh, okay. What is the...
I'm sorry, I'm really screwing myself up. Innocence with a T and not with a C.
I understand, it's plural, innocence.
Yeah, as in Mark Twain's Innocence Abroad.
Okay.
Yeah.
Innocence Abroad.
Not Innocence with a C.
Were you using Mark Twain as a...
Yes.
As a model on that. What period does that cover? That's
that covers the 1956 to 1958 period. But also I comment on my reflections over the last 40 years throughout the book and compare it with things as recently as 1995, McMurdo.
I began to read it last night and I saw where you did that up front. Okay, are you thinking of another book?
Yes, I am working on one right now.
Got a title for it?
Oh, a working title. To pick a title is a lot of effort and work with the publisher to get a good title. So my working title is just Over the West Antarctic Ice Sheet,
mm-hmm.
but mainly comprising the work in flying and over snow traverse we did in 60-61 and 61-62, in that period of my life. It'll again be in a memoir form.
Okay. What advice do you have for anyone going to the ice today?
Someone once said, and I used that in my book, you can only go to Antarctica the first time once. This isn't original with me, but it's a good line. So keep a diary, keep a journal. My sons have traveled the world and have not kept journals. And I wish they had, because in 30 or 40 years they would like to be able to go back to those. It's the prime source of, it's the closest to the actual data you can get when you go back and try and remember what happened 40 years ago. And I've talked to people at Ellsworth who have very faulty memories of some of the things. They tell the story so many times, but without the actual data book, in effect, a journal, you can't go back and check, on this day there was this flight, etc.
Well, that's good. Now, tell me, do you plan to go back?
Oh, yes, I intend to go back.
What's NSF's policy on grants today? Is there an age cutoff anymore?
No, there never has been, to my knowledge.
Well, it was. They tried to cut off Emory Friedman.
But that wasn't because of age. Not the grant. That may have been he couldn't pass the physical exam or something.
Yeah.
Well, that's a different subject.
Yeah,
but
anyway.
No, there's no prohibition.
Well, good. I'm glad they don't. But they used to emphasize that with our doctor.
You're talking about medical.
Medical.
Yeah. No, there may be medical cutoff,
yeah.
Me or anyone else.
Yeah.
But as far as putting in a proposal, I intend to put in a proposal for cooperative,
mm-hmm.
More aeromagnetic work with the Germans this June.
Good. So you're not done?
No.
Just starting.
Right.
It's just getting going. Okay. Well, that's it. I think that's one of the better interviews. You've got your act together. It's